Alright, so I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jim Powers.
Hey, Jim.
And we are going to start this meeting like we do every other one with a moment of silent meditation to be used as you see fit, and we'll follow it with serenity prayer. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We are going to start on chapter 5 today. We have spent about 4 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 4 weeks, going over two things. And that's what, and that's the way Bill was writing this book. The problem and the solution. Step 1 and step 2. And he was writing this really to try to, if you remember, the big book was the original 12-step call. They just mailed it out to people, and they hoped people read the book, implemented the spiritual principles, and got sober and had a great way of life. But during the time that he was writing the first, four chapters and part of How It Works, it was being sent out to all the other members, you know, the first 100. And every time he would send it out, he would get back cross-throughs, change this. You know, getting 100 alcoholics to agree on anything is pretty tough. And so Bill got almost to the point where he was going to quit. And he told everybody that either they were going to give him permission to write the book, or they could write the book themselves. After he wrote How It Works in the 12 Steps, he said, either I'm going to write the rest of the book and y'all can have input, or you write the book. Now, having all those alcoholics give him sole discretion on how to write the book, you know, you got to think about that. They're just giving away all their power and all their input. But you know why they did it? Because they didn't want to write the book. And Bill was the best one at doing it so far, so they decided to leave him alone. Hey, Greg. They decided to leave him alone after How It Works. And How It Works was rewritten 44 times. That's how many times it went out, came back, went out, came back, went out, came back, and they had to keep rewriting it, and that's why Bill got so upset. But, you know, all the way up to this point, he's been telling us we're powerless over alcohol, our lives are unmanageable. Step one, okay? Unmanageable drunk, unmanageable sober. And step two, that we have to have a power greater than ourselves. We just read that last week when we were in We Agnostics, that we had to find a power greater than ourselves, and that was the object of the book, is to find a power that we could depend on that would solve all our problems. I got a friend doing this down in Orlando right now, and he has taught me a tremendous amount of things, and he does this at the start of each one of his sessions. And I haven't done it yet, but I think I'm going to do it. It's another prayer, and it's a good prayer. It's called the set-aside prayer. So if you just bow your head for a second. Lord, help me set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I know about myself, everything I know about my fellows, and everything I think I know about my recovery. All for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much-needed new experience in my recovery. Amen. So we're going to start with How It Works on Chapter 5. And I'm going to impart some history as we go along, and the very first word is rarely. And people said that Bill originally wrote never. Now, Bill Wilson, before he passed away, told a longtime member that he would never have put that word there, because there would have been an alcoholic who would have done everything this book said and still gone out to drink just to spite him. And so we put the word, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now their path was this path of recovery. The program of action is the path of recovery. And up to this point, we've just been talking about the problem and the solution. The next sentence is going to tell us who is not going to get this program. There are those who do not recover. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Will not and cannots are not going to get this program. They've closed their mind to all spiritual concepts. From the back of the book, they have got contempt prior to investigation, and that's the way I was for about 3.5 years. I was a will not, not a could not. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. And here it is. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. There's only a couple demands in this book. There's a lot of musts, there's some requirements, but this is it right here. And the second time you'll see a demand, it'll have the same thing. Demand rigorous honesty. Because if you can't be honest, rigorously honest with yourself, you're not going to be able to do these steps that are coming up. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. It goes on to say, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. So when we tell our stories, we tell it in a general way. If, here's a condition, if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. Now, if you want what we have, what did they have? They had sobriety. They had a way of living that they never had before. They had a spiritual awakening. So if you want what they have and are willing to go to any length to get it, willingness being the key there, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked, stopped. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. You know, the bottle was not an easier, softer way. Even though I continued to try to avoid doing this, I continued to try avoiding having to look at myself or making amends, and I continued to get drunk. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Nil being nothing. You know, you can't do half this program and get half this program. You either do it all or you get nil. You get nothing. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. We found that in the chapter before. That one is God. May you find him now. Now, we hear this read almost at every AA meeting. Chapter 5, How It Works, is read almost at every AA meeting I go to. As a newcomer walking through the door, it's a little bit confusing. My friend in Orlando, Rob, he explains it like, you're in a math class and you walk in for the first day and they're on chapter 5. They're in calculus. And you don't even know how to do fractions because you haven't done anything in chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. So to be able to do this, you've got to do it the way it was written. The way Bill wrote it, he wrote it as it flowed all the way through him, and he wrote it with the guidance of God. And I'll read a couple of excerpts from some different books in a minute. But one of the things that we hear a lot is, you know, there's no timelines in doing these steps. You know, easy does it. Don't get in a rush. You know, those things like that. And what we're going to find out is Bill had timelines built throughout this book on when to do things. May you find him now is a timeline right then. You know, by now you've read the first 4 chapters talking about the problem and where the solution was. So you better be ready to have a God in your life of your understanding now before you go any further. Half measures avail us nothing. Half of nothing is nothing. 3/4 of nothing is nothing. 99% of nothing is still nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Okay? Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Now remember, the steps, as written right here and on the wall, are summaries of the action that you have to do to get to the spiritual awakening that we're all looking for. That's why we're here. We're trying to get to that spiritual awakening. And so to see the summary of the steps, that's one thing. But the steps are in the meat of the book. And he explains them. He explains step one and step two in 59 pages, almost 60 pages. And why do you think that is? Because step one, you've got to know you've got a problem and that you can't control your own life. And step two is a solution to all my problems, is a power greater than myself. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Now, the suggested steps sometimes are on the wall. I know the group at Albany has it, says suggested steps. You know, these things are life and death. These steps are, to me, life and death. And so the analogy he uses, Rob down there uses, is, you know, when you go up in an airplane and the guy pushes you out and tells you that red ripcord right there, he suggests that about halfway down, you pull it. Well, that's what this suggestion is to me. It's a command. It's a do this or you're not going to get what you're looking for. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The first four chapters and part of this one. One and two. Three, made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I've said this many times. If you had told me, like some of the early members wanted, to have a Christian program, some members wanted to have no God in the book, some members wanted the Buddha, Allah, whatever. If any of that had been in this book or on the wall, I don't think I'd be here. I can't swear I wouldn't. But coming from a non-religious family, I didn't want to come in here and be at church. I came in here wanting to save my life. Now, I can go to church and be saved and, you know, hallelujah and all that. But that's not what I was looking for. I was looking for a way to stop drinking permanently or die. So, as we understood Him, we being the first 100, that's who they're talking about right now when they're using the word we. I have gone back through this book, and I have worked with my guys after, you know, they've done the 12 steps, probably after a year, I take them back through this part, and I change we and everything to I. Because we're not going to do my moral inventory. Right? We're not going to do my 8-step amends list. We're not going to do my 9-step amends. I'm going to be doing them. These are things that I have to do. So I have to do a lot of these things. They're saying these are the things each individual one that had input into this book is what they did to get to that spiritual experience. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of characters. And remember, Bill is using the 6 steps of the Oxford group when he's doing this. When he's writing this book, there are only 6 steps that he knows about. All right? And I'm going to read something about that in just a minute. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. All right? In AA Comes of Age, Bill talks a little bit about how he did this, how he wrote those 12 steps right there. And it says, this particular evening, as my mind ran over the developments, it seemed to me that the program was still not definite enough. It might be a long time before readers of the book in distant places and lands could be personally contacted. Therefore, our literature would have to be as clear and comprehensive as possible. And we've already talked about clear-cut directions, specific instructions. Our steps would have to be more explicit. There must not be a single loophole through which a rationalizing alcoholic could wiggle out. We couldn't have a loophole. I would look for every loophole I could to find an easier way than to do what I did, which is the 12 steps, program of action. Maybe our six chunks of truth should get broken up into smaller pieces. Those six chunks of truth were the six steps that the Oxford group used. Thus, we could better get the distant reader over the barrel, and at the same time, we might be able to broaden and deepen the spiritual implications of our whole presentation. So far as I can remember, this was all I had in mind when the writing began. Now, what he did was, when he started to write the 12 steps and how it works, he prayed first. He relaxed and asked for guidance. He prayed. And with a speed that was astonishing considering my jaggering emotions, I completed the first draft. It took perhaps a half hour. 30 minutes for him to draft the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 44 times to have it rewritten before he had had enough. The words kept right on coming. When I reached the stopping point, I numbered the new steps. They added up to 12. Somehow this number seemed significant. Feeling greatly relieved now, I commenced to reread the draft. And then it goes on to talk about how some members came over and read it with him, and some of them were greatly pleased with what he had written, and he read them the new version of the program, now the 12 steps. A guy named Howard and his friend reacted violently. "Why 12 steps?" they demanded. And then, "You got too much God in these steps. You'll scare people away." The original draft had a lot more God in it. And I don't have it with me today. Maybe I'll bring it with me next week. But there are things about getting on your knees and asking God to remove your defects of character, withholding nothing. That was step 7. "You've got too much God in these steps, so it'll scare people away." And what do you mean about getting those drunks down on their knees when they ask to have all their shortcomings removed? And who wants all their shortcomings removed anyhow? I want to hang on to a couple. As he saw my uneasiness, Howard added, "Well, some of this stuff really does sound good after all. But Bill, you've got to tone it down some. It's too stiff. The average alcoholic just won't buy it the way it stands." Now, Bill got kind of defensive about that, and I don't know about y'all, but whenever I used to get real defensive and get in an argument, he goes on to say that when Lois came home, the argument stopped. So, you know, Lois had a calming effect, I think, on Bill quite a bit after he got sober. She didn't have much effect on him trying to get him sober. And later on, you'll find out in one of her books that she got so mad that AA and the Oxford group helped Bill when all the years that she had tried, that one night he was off to one of his meetings and she took off one of her shoes and threw it at him. And the book that was written about her was called When Love Was Not Enough. And that's exactly what it was, when love was not enough to get him to stay sober. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Then it tells us, "Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these spiritual principles, to these principles. We are not saints. The point is," here's the point, "that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic," and here it goes on to say, Who is going to be the ones that this book is going to be able to help? "Our description of the alcoholic," that's the first 60 pages in the doctor's opinion, "the chapter to the agnostic, chapter 4, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, step 1. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, step 2, rewritten. see that God could and would if he were sought. Step two, rewritten in a different way. Now, the book right there, in its original form, said something, and I'm not going to quote it correctly, but it said something like, if you are not convinced yet, please reread this book to this point or throw it away. Because the first 60 pages telling you the problem and telling you the solution, if you're not convinced and you've reread the book to this point again, if you're not convinced, you're not going to go any further. You're not going to do the rest of these steps. Throw the book away, go get drunk. Come back when you can do what it says. Get convinced. Because now, what we've done is we've just ended step two. Because the next sentence says it. Being convinced, we are at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life, and I was taught that will is thoughts and life is actions. So decided to turn our thoughts and our actions, our will and our lives over to God as we understood him. And just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? All right? They're going to tell you. Bill right now is back, going to be writing this book by himself with the help of others. But he is now getting ready to tell you what we're going to do. And it says right there, the first requirement, the first action, as I call it, is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I have to have somebody else running my life. I have to have a power greater than myself. I have to have a creator that I believe in to run my life, because I have proven time and again before I got here and after I got here that when I tried to take control, even in sobriety, when I tried to take control of my life, I ran it into the ditch. And so any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. So even though we might have good motives, if we're running our life on self-will, we're going to run into something. We're going to run into a ditch. We're going to run into something. Most people try to live life by self-propulsion. Each person is like the actor. He's going to tell you now what I'm like. Each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Now, if only everybody would do what I told him to do and act the way I told him to act, everything would be great. But they don't. And even if they did, I still wouldn't be satisfied. I wouldn't. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. You know, that describes me. Sometimes. And then it goes on to describe me some more. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistic, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. And then he decides to exert his self-will himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he is somewhat at fault, right? Alcoholics are never going to be totally at fault, are we? Well, somewhat at fault. He is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Self. He's telling you right there, self is his basic trouble. Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? is he not a victim of the delusion that he can force rest these satisfactions and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? Victim of a delusion. I'm telling myself something over and over. That's a lie. That's a delusion. I'm continually to tell myself over and over, I can control this. I can handle this. I don't need your help. I don't need God's help. That's a delusion. Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in the best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Step three is an absolute step of surrender. And I truly believe that the first two steps are thoughts, then we make a decision in step three, and then 4 through 9 we're going to take the actions. And this comes from Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Let me see where it is. Okay, on page 101 he says, when they were doing the 12 steps, they were doing the 12 steps or the 6 steps before the book was written. They were doing them 3 or 4 hours. That's how fast they were getting through the program that the Oxford group had. And they were taking them upstairs, getting them on their knees to surrender, which I felt was a very important part. The surrender was more important. It was a must. More than important, it was a must. Bob E. came into AA in February 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting you were powerless over alcohol, your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. Well, that's step two. And it goes on to say at the bottom of 61, our actor, me, is self-centered and egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining over the sins of the 20th century. No. Complaining over the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers, are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. There was me. I kept going to jail thinking society was wrong. Well, I was an outlaw. I was supposed to be in jail. And the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Locked up in the mental institution, locked up in jail. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, our self-pity? Now it's going to go on. And I like to do this with my guys. You know, when they call me, I said, listen, you know, I hear what you're saying. Your problems are on page 62. Your solution's on page 63. So it goes on to say, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Self-will gets me nothing but pain. And so he comes to say, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of the selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Now, that's probably the second or third time that he's talked about that this is a deadly disease, that it kills us. And now he's not talking about alcohol. Now he's talking about selfishness, self-centeredness, resentment. We must, or it kills us. And who makes that possible? God makes that possible. And there often seems no way entirely getting rid of self without God's aid, without His aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we try to reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. We had to have God's help. Our own conception of God. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. I didn't think I played God when I came here. I just didn't get that part. And I sat with my sponsor and I said, I'm not out there, you know, playing God. And so he asked me, you know, what about your family? I said, well, I'm the breadwinner. I'm the guy who goes out to work every day. I'm the one that, you know, does the checkbook. I'm the one that pays the bills. And he said, you know how many times you said I'm right there? You don't think that's playing God? Not once did you say, well, God's in charge of anything. You're in charge of everything, Jim. And you have to quit playing God. Because it didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. Okay? We're admitting that we can't do it on our own. We're having to do step 3, which is when we're going to turn our will and our life, our thoughts and our actions, over to the God that we understand. God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are His agents. He is the Father. We are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Now, early in Bill's story, he talks about building a foundation. And then later on, it talks about putting in a cornerstone. And now, we're talking about putting in a keystone of a triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And the keystone is that center stone at the very top of the arch that holds it together. And the arch goes in and out, in and out. But if you take away that keystone of that arch, what happens? The arch crumbles. It falls down. It falls apart. And so continually, Bill, I always thought, you know, Bill must have been some kind of engineer. Well, he studied engineering because he talks about different designs of this house we're building on a firm bedrock, not on soft sand or quicksand. Cornerstones, the start of the foundation. The keystone holds the arch together. He continues to build this house that we're going to live in. This house of serenity, this house of peace, this house of spirituality. Okay, on top of the next page. When we sincerely took such a position, I was taught that I have to take a secondary position to God. God's in charge of everything. Everything. And so I have to take that secondary position. All sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He provided what we needed. He provided what we needed. If we kept close to Him, that's step 11, and performed His work well, that's step 12. He is providing everything I need today. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs, and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Doesn't mean that I am in church, accept Christ, and I'm a reborn Christian. That's not what it means. It means I'm getting a second chance at life. I have a second chance. We're the only people I know that get to live two lives. We're blessed that way. because of this program. We lived the life before we got here, and then we lived the life after. I'm going to read that paragraph again, because what that says to me is the third step promises, before we even do the third step. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in. That's a promise. As we enjoyed peace of mind. Promise. As we discovered we could face life successfully. Promise. As we became conscious of His presence. Promise. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and hereafter. We were reborn. Now we're at step three. And many of us said to our Maker, all right, He does not tell us what prayer you have to use. Continue throughout the book, He's going to say things like, something like this, you know, or we did this. But He's not saying, you have to do this exact prayer. There are a lot of times where I tell my guys, write down your own third step prayer, and let's do it. And then let's do the one out of the book. And because I'm not a biblical scholar, I never read this prayer the way it's written in the book. I read it in English, which is what I know. And if you want to, you can. You don't have to. But if you want to, this is the way I've been taught to do it. On my knees. So I'm going to get down, get on my knees, and I'm going to do the third step prayer. If you want to read it with me, you can. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as You will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Your will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of Your power, Your love, and Your way of life. May I do Your will always. All right? Now, I'm going to go back and I'm going to go over that prayer and I'm going to break it down a little bit. And I know somebody in this room's heard me say that before and they'll just have to listen to it again. The first thing, God. The first word of that prayer, God. What I'm saying is, I believe in a power greater than myself already. I'm saying that I am not God. I'm asking God for something. So I am admitting that there is this power greater than myself. I offer myself to Thee. I'm offering myself to God. I don't know what to do, God. I need Your help. To build with me and do with me as You will. All right? I'm saying to God, do anything You want. Build me up and do with me as You want me to do. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I'm asking God to take away my self-will, my self-pity, my self-centeredness in that prayer right there, that I might better do Your will. Take away my difficulties. Now I'm asking Him to take away my problems, take away my difficulties. And a lot of my difficulties are completely in my head. They are not real. They have been delusional for so long that I just think they're difficulties. But I can tell you this. I had serum hepatitis when I was 17 and 18. Two different rounds of serum hepatitis because of dirty needles. And so all my life, I carried the hepatitis enzymes in my liver. I could never donate blood because it had hepatitis in it. When I got sober, I was challenged by my son. And I still can't believe this, but I was challenged by my son to become an emergency medical technician. Now, most of you all heard my story. You know I got an 8th grade education, and then I got my GED on a chain gang. And he wanted me to take one of the most advanced medical courses there is known to mankind. You have to have 3 different courses. You have to make an 80 on all the courses at the state level in Florida to be able to take the national exam. Okay? And I went there, and there are words that are, you know, 3 feet long that have to do with the heart. There's miles and miles of bloodstreams and cells and all this stuff. The human body, like Bill said in his story, is a magnificent mechanism. And so never once did I even think of praying, God, take away my hepatitis. Never once. I went to the EMT school because I told my son I would. I paid the money. I took the course. I told the paramedic instructor on the second day there, there is no way I'm going to be able to pass this course. I'm just not that smart. I can't do these words. And he said, Jim, why don't we do this? Why don't we take it one day at a time? Now, I don't know where he got that. I never saw him at a meeting. But, you know, I took that course one day at a time. I studied hard for the next day. And I wound up with two B's and an A, and then I passed the National Registry for Emergency Medical Technicians with the GED I got on the chain gang. Now, here's... I tell that story a lot when I talk, and my sponsor always says, but you never give them what happened. And what happened was, God took away my difficulties. I never went and got interferon treatment. I never went to a liver doctor. I knew for the rest of my life I was going to have hepatitis. I knew it. So I never prayed, God, take that away from me. But when I passed that EMT course, they said, now you need to go get the Hep A and B vaccine. In case you go into something like Katrina or something like that, you need to have that vaccine. So I went to my doctor, and it had been 5 or 6 years since I'd had blood tests. And he said, well, let's do this instead. It's cheaper than me giving you that vaccine just to go back, because it's right here in your records. You've got hepatitis. You've got C. That covers A and B. He said, but let's just test you again. You haven't had blood tests in about 5 years. And I said, okay. And then about a week later, his secretary called and said, the doctor would like to see you in the office. Now, to me, when I go have blood tests and the doctor wants to see me in the office, that is bad news. In my mind, that is bad news. So I went, met with the doctor. I went in there. He opened my file. Some of you might have heard me say, I've got a red dot on my file. That's in case he's not in the office and I come in there. Or that's in case my file goes to the emergency room with me and that red dot signifies I'm an alcoholic, drug addict, don't give me anything narcotic if you can avoid it. Okay? And I have that on my file. And he knows I was in AA. And he says, I don't know how to explain this to you as a medical professional, but you have no enzymes of hepatitis in your body. None whatsoever. And I didn't do anything to get rid of them. So when that prayer is said, it always takes me back. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. So by finishing the story, which I never do when I talk because I'd run out of time, but that's exactly what happened to me, is he took away my difficulties in that third step, and I never even knew it. So if he can remove hepatitis from me, why can't he remove financial insecurity? Why can't he remove unwarranted fear? Why can't he remove all my defects of character a little at a time? That victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of his power, his love, and his way of life. And may I do your will always. Then they give you a little warning. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We thought well before taking this step. It didn't say it up there, all right, think well before you're going to do this next step. It says it afterwards, because you have to be ready to abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Now, it says we found it very desirable to take the spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife. I don't know. I didn't have that one. Best friend or spiritual advisor. And this is the surrendering that I talk about so much. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. Okay? The wording, of course, was quite optional. That's what I said a minute ago. He's not telling you what prayers you have to have. You can write your own prayers throughout the book. Some of the members wanted no God in the book at all. Some of the members wanted the book to be a Christian book. And all these conflicting ideas were coming from three different groups. The group in New York had a lot of atheists and agnostics in it. And that's where Bill was writing from. The group in Akron had a lot of Protestants in it. So they liked God. And the group in Cleveland was a lot of Catholics. And so this group in New York was battling the group in Akron, and the group in Cleveland was battling the group in Akron because they were still doing it the Oxford group way. And what the Oxford group did was had public confession. You confessed your sins to the entire group of people. The Catholic bishops up in Cleveland didn't want their members to be doing public confession. And so that's when the split started happening. Cleveland broke off. Bill broke off up in New York from the Oxford group, and then Dr. Bob broke off from the Oxford group in Akron, and then they formed a group of former drunks. They had different names before the book was written, but Alcoholics Anonymous started as the name of the group in Cleveland, and most agree that even though Bill writes that he didn't take the name for the book from there, that's how the book got its name. So it says the wording was, of course, quite optional. So long as we express the idea, voicing it without reservation. Now, I've told you before, if I have a reservation, I'm going somewhere. So if I have no reservation about voicing that prayer out loud, and I have no reservation voicing the third step prayer out loud, I can do it in front of thousands. I can do it in front of my sponsees. I can do it on a daily basis. God, I offer myself to you. Do with me. Take this load off of me, Lord. And this was only a beginning, though, if honestly and humbly is what I feel getting on your knees is, made an effort, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. This was only a beginning, though, if honestly and humbly made an effort, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. You don't have to wait till you get through the ninth step to start having promises come true in this book. You know, my life started getting great the day that I admitted that I was an alcoholic. The day that I said to myself, I admitted to myself without reservations that I was an alcoholic, my life started getting better. Now, if my life started getting better then, and it's getting better through step two in knowing more about the solution. And now that I've accepted, there is a God. There is a God watching over us all. There is a God watching over me. And my life's getting better today. Why do I need to go any further? Why don't we just have a three-step program? Because I want better. I want more. That's the bottom line. And you remember we talked about a couple different times about people take your time, don't get in a hurry. Okay, you just said the third step prayer, right? What's the next sentence say? Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous actions, steps 4 through 9. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning. That's step 4. But what he's saying, he didn't say, okay, take a week after you've done step 3. And think about it. Take an hour after you've done step 3 and think about it. He's saying start your house cleaning now. And like I said, in the beginning when they only had 6 steps, 3 or 4 hours, they were through the 6-step program. They had done their house cleaning. They had made the list of their amends. They had surrendered to God. They did all this in 3 and 4 hours. Desperate alcoholics wanting relief. So when it says we launched, to me, launching is something that shoots right off. You get done with step 3, you shoot right into step 4. Personal house cleaning, step 4. We're on 64, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless what? At once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in our troublesome in ourselves which have been blocking us. before I go on, I want to read that again. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. And here's where it goes on. Booze was not my problem. Here I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking, and on page 64, our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to what my problem was. We had to get down to causes and conditions. And I'm going, wait a minute, I've stopped drinking. Okay, so what? Have you changed? Are you trying to help people? Have you made amends? Have you ever even looked at yourself, Jim? And the answer was no. So, that is what it's meaning. You know, liquor and drugs were not my problem. My problem was I was a selfish, self-centered son of a bitch. And that's the easiest way to say it. I really was. But I didn't know it. You know, I just thought I was a nice guy with a drinking problem. I didn't go out beating people up. Not after my first 25 years I stopped doing that. I just thought, you know, okay, I've got a little drinking problem. My wife thinks I have a drinking problem. My dad thinks I have a drinking problem. My stepmother has recommended me going to AA, and I'm in AA, and it takes me about 27 days before I can actually not take a drink, and it takes me 3.5 years before I can start working a program, because I fought this thing tooth and nail. I was not going to admit I was powerless. And I almost died. I almost died. So liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions. And so we're going to start on the causes and conditions, and we're going to start in 10 minutes. I'm going to take a 10-minute break and let everybody have a cigarette, okay?